Welcome to the Philosophy of Psychoanalysis.
The lecture you are about to listen to was created by Associate Professor Doris McIlwain. This course has been made publicly available, but was recorded for a live student audience. Please enjoy. Lecture 4, Repression.
Now, today's lecture is a bit of a wild ride. The concepts are pivotal to psychoanalysis, but I don't think they're too hard. But that's for you to judge, I suppose. Okay. Are there unconscious mental states? That kind of nomenclature of unconscious, that's pretty much the way it's always written. So if you can just get used to reading that, UCS is unconscious, that would be great. Short answer is yes, they definitely are. And what do we mean by that? Well, we mean things that are operative mentally at the moment, which at the moment I'm unaware of. Okay, now that's not the same thing as brain states. I'm not aware of whether or not there's high blood volume in my amygdala, and I never will be, okay? But having high blood volume in my amygdala might make me pay attention to my environment in some way, and I might notice that I'm slightly fearful, okay? So I might notice fear as a mental state, but I'm never going to go, my right amygdala has got an increased blood flow. It's not going to happen. So that's non-conscious, okay? Some people, when they don't want to sort of be Freudian or nothing to do with psychoanalysis, they say subconscious rather than unconscious. Let's just bite the bullet and say unconscious, shall we? And non-conscious if we mean brain states. Okay, one can never become aware of brain states. They're not mental processes. They're physical processes. Of course, they underpin mental processes, because there's no such thing as mind stuff separate from physical stuff. But you can't directly know your brain states. Now, the interesting thing about unconscious mental states is that you can never, unfortunately, have direct evidence for them. Okay, so say I'm conscious of being afraid. And you say, how do you feel? I go, oh, I'm a bit afraid today. You know, I feel a bit scared. You know, I've got so much to do, right? I can introspect. I can directly experience my fear, and I can verbally report to you that I'm afraid. I can then also take steps to control my level of fear by doing things, so I'm not so afraid. That's the advantage of being consciously aware of things. But if you say to me, how are you feeling? And I go, fine. You go, your hands are looking a bit jittery, Doris. Oh, really? Oh, yeah. You know, in other words, I'm afraid, but I don't know I'm afraid. You know I'm afraid. My dog knows I'm afraid, right? But I don't know that I'm afraid. And knowing your unconscious processes can be like that sometimes. You have to snoop on yourself. You have to indirectly infer, I must be afraid because I'm really shaky and my mouth is dry, okay? And for some people, you don't directly experience certain states, okay? So that can be an unconscious fear, and it's quite common. But to get evidence of unconscious processes, when you can't just ask the person about them, you need multiple sources of evidence. And sometimes you need multiple sources of evidence from many different observers. And this has been one of the biggest barriers to psychoanalysis, particularly clinical psychoanalysis, having scientific respectability. Because people say, well, if you can't get direct evidence for these processes, how do you know they exist? Now, physics deals with entities and processes and things that you can't get direct evidence for, and they only can be inferred by their effect. Like the notion that gas molecules have different sizes is a theoretical assumption, and you try to compress different gases with different molecules of different sizes, and the little molecules slot in between the bigger molecules, and that's your theory of gas compression. And it's, you know, I'd like to say it isn't physics, but it is, okay? In other words, it's not an unusual thing to have to use indirect evidence for the existence of something theoretical. So psychoanalysis is not really out on a limb in that, but it's got other problems. One of the major problems is that to get really good at discerning unconscious processes, particularly, and this is a crucial distinction, Doris jumps up and down, essay question, exam question, short answer question. Okay, particularly when you're dealing with dynamically unconscious processes, okay, you have to be pretty good to spot them. And that once you're good at spotting them, it's like a chair that's standing in the middle of the room and it's bright red. You couldn't miss it. But before you're trained to be able to see those things, you don't see them. You actually don't see them. So psychology is a bit spooky. Because once you learn to discern other people's unconscious processes, you actually have got a slight edge on that other person, in that you've got access to more about their mental states than they have. Okay, so you know more about their mental states than they do, and hopefully you use that to help them. But there is also the potential, as psychopaths, Machiavellians, and narcissists and charismatic leaders show, that if you know more about a person's mental state than they do, you can manipulate and exploit them. And advertising does that all the time to us. The real challenge, I think, is to come and be able to infer the existence of unconscious mental states in oneself. In other words, to come to excavate, explore, know more about what's going on at a bodily level about yourself. And so what we actually need to avoid is that the only people who write and do research about this kind of thing are trained clinicians who've sometimes taken 7 or 8 years to get to where they are. Now, the problem with anything like that is that an outsider is going to say, yes, but you're in a cult, you know, you believe in Freud. Of course, you're going to find evidence that sustains and supports Freud. So, you know, your evidence is not taken quite as seriously because you're seen as a true believer. So what you want is people that are knowledgeable, but that don't worship Freud, but people that also take theoretical definitions very seriously. And that's one thing that psychoanalysts do superbly. They are very, very nuanced thinkers. They make a distinction between dynamically unconscious, preconscious, access conscious. Like, they've got all sorts of gradations. And I'm not going to belabor them today, but I have got a very good recent article that was sent to me yesterday, which I was just reading this morning, and it's very, very nice, you know, because it's not an all or none thing that I'm either conscious or I'm not conscious of something. You know, I can be conscious of something, but it's just at the level of a bodily awareness, but I can't put words to it. I might want to share it with you, but I can't actually capture it in words. Okay? I might really know something, so I can give you 17 different words for it and tell you that it's not as strong today as it was yesterday, and it's not as strong now as it was 2 seconds ago. In other words, there's all sorts of levels of awareness. It's not a simple binary of conscious or unconscious. But I'm going to talk today as though it's quite simple, that you've either got conscious, preconscious, or dynamically unconscious. And those are kind of the three distinctions I'm putting up today. Now, people like Kjellstrom, I'm just going to be really honest with you, people like Kjellstrom really annoy me. When I read them, I kind of, you know, it's quite hard to keep focused because I get kind of irritated, partly because Kjellstrom doesn't really want there to be such a thing as a dynamic unconscious, doesn't want to take seriously motivational forces like drives, would be really delighted if affects could just get rubbed out of psychology texts, right? And so they sort of say, he says, and a whole lot of people in his style say, look, we've got to get away from the Freudian unconscious as this seething cauldron of lust and desire, as if we're some kind of animal. We are some kind of animal, you know. Can't we have a gentler, kinder, cognitive unconscious? Well, you can. It's called the preconscious, and it's not what Freud's talking about. So go for it, but that's not what Freud's talking about. So you can do research on the cognitive unconscious, but you're not actually proving anything about the existence or the non-existence of the dynamic unconscious. It's not that that can't be done, but you ain't doing it in that paradigm is really important. It's, and, you know, contemporary relational psychoanalysts are absolutely obsessed by what Kjellstrom would call the kind of cognitive unconscious. In other words, they're really interested in things that we don't bring into awareness because we're attending away from them. We're just not noticing them. They're inconvenient. They're difficult. And so we just distract ourselves and don't notice them. Okay? But you wouldn't ever suggest that my attending away from something wasn't motivated. I'm attending away from it because it's potentially disruptive for me in some ways. I'll give you an example. I got sent an invitation to a conference, and it's about academic workloads and well-being, and it's being held in a center here at Macquarie. And the poster for it is of this great big elephant in a conference room. And of course, the elephant in the room that can't be named is that academics are massively overworked at the moment and very, very stressed about it. And I sent it on to the person that normally sends around conference invitations, and it didn't get forwarded because it's an awkward thing. It's not something, it's the elephant in the room. It's not something we really want to speak about. Now, that's an example of, oh, someone was just busy and didn't forward on the email, but it's not insignificant what it was that wasn't sent on. You see, when you're a Freudian, you're a pain in the butt. Okay. So the kind of gender unconscious, it's certainly in the picture of what Freud's interested in, but it's not what he was meaning by the dynamic unconscious. What he means by the dynamic unconscious, and I'm going to call it secondary repression, and I'll tell you about primary repression in a minute, is not something that doesn't gain consciousness because it's weak or because you're not attending to it. It's something that's too present. It's kind of like in your face. Something that precisely, in spite of its intensity, is unable to enter consciousness. Now, we learned last week that drives seek pleasure. Why would we ever repress something that seeks to bring us pleasure? Well, it's not that simple. Drives cause pleasure in one part of the mind and unpleasure in another part of the mind. Well, how could it be that a drive causes unpleasure anywhere? I mean, they're pleasure-seeking engines, if you like. Well, pleasure is bodily, but it can conflict with your morality. It can cause you guilt. Like if you're on a diet and you're eating fettuccine boscaiola with lots of mushrooms and sour cream, your body's going, and your mind's going, oh my God, saturated fat, you know, carbohydrates, so guilt, anxiety. Okay, so we split like that. No problem at all in life. So let's look closely at conflict. I said last week, probably slightly incomprehensibly to you, but it's important, I'd like you to take it on board if that's okay, that a drive is a knowing relation. A drive sets me in connection to something in the environment, something in the world, a state of affairs. So, for instance, my sex drive sets me in knowing relation to, say, a cute person. My morality might say, but you're not married to that person and you don't want to commit to that person, so it's wrong to even desire that person. Okay, so I'm experiencing conflict. So let's have a look, let's zero in a little bit more to that knowing relation, which is what today crucially requires you to understand. That is, that the knowing relation, or what the drive sets up between part of you and the world, has got two components to it, and this is really, really crucial. One component is cognitive or ideational. It's about an idea. I believe that that person is somewhat attractive. Okay? That's the belief, right? The affective charge component of that is yum. Okay? In other words, it's just like the fettuccine boscaiola and it's sex, not hunger. Okay? That you really think that person is lovely. Okay. Doris does very bad diagrams. Apologies all round. I just don't know why. I can't draw on computers, but this is my little attempt. So on the one hand, you've got morality, and you've got the two components. You've got the affective charge, yum. You've got the belief, I think that person is rather attractive. Now, the belief can be repressed, but you can't repress the affect, because affect is energy. Do you remember last week I told you that affects once were actions? Rage was smashing your opponent. Fear was running away. So when you feel that state, your body's in a state to do something, right? So yes, I can forget what I was thinking about that desirous person, but I'm left with that desire, as one of my favorite poets says, with that idiot love trembling like a car. Okay, that's sort of just that sense of, oh, what am I doing in this state? Okay, so the affective charge doesn't go away. It can't go away. It's energy. The second law of thermodynamics is that energy can change its form. It can dissipate and go to lower levels of energy, but it can't be eradicated. And the charge of affect as energy actually can't be repressed. You can repress the idea, but you can't repress the affective charge. And so what often happens, according to Freud, is that it changes its nature. It gets split off from the idea that makes sense of what you're feeling, and you're left trembling like a car, but you don't know why. So you just feel anxiety. I'm just really anxious. Why? I don't know. I'm just really anxious. Okay, so what this shows is that beliefs are different from motivation. Beliefs are kind of cognitions, and they're different and not equal to motivation. So what I'm trying to suggest here is that drives as somatic forces are kind of energy, but they simultaneously engage in cognition with the environment. And normally what they do is they initiate what's called consummatory actions. In other words, it's not good to be in a drive state. Once the drives get too intense, it's kind of unbearable, and you want to do something to turn them off. And usually that's by eating or by making love or whatever. But the hunger drive's not that modifiable. You can fantasize about ice creams for a while, but ultimately you need to find real things to eat. But the sex drive is much more plastic and modifiable in its expression. We can satisfy it partially by fantasy and by ideas and by displacing it onto other things like works of art, painting, hard work, writing, running, whatever. So what this shows is that drives are affected by information in the world about where they might get things that satisfy them. They're influenced by information about what frustrates them. And they're shaped. Your drives get shaped in the course of your life by the affective consequences. And I noticed when I was going through the lecture this morning that I'd only put the moral ones, you know, shame, disgust, and guilt. And I thought, what about delight, joy, pleasure? Like, you know, when things are good, we learn that too. We learn where to go and find the things that make us happy and satisfied. So I put that in this morning. Okay, but the things that psychoanalysis are most interested in are the things that cause us pain. And guilt is a form of mental psychic pain. So when drives hit the guilt barrier, we feel moral anxiety. And this is where things start to get very, very tricky indeed. And I bet I lose you in the next 5 slides. So let me know when or if I do. Okay, so repression is a psychological activity, and it's motivated by anxiety. In other words, I might start to desire someone, and I might think this conflicts with my moral stance. I don't want to know that I desire that person. And so I repress that thought or that impulse or that feeling before I fully know it, before it's fully conscious. In other words, repression prevents me from knowing things about myself that clash with my moral image of myself. So far, I desire him or her. This clashes with my morality. My morality says I should only desire someone I'll marry or at least commit to. But for it to clash with my morality, I have to know that I actually desire him or her. So does that mean that repression entails my being conscious that I desire him or her? Well, I've got to give a few paradoxical things. I've got to give an account of some paradoxes here. How can repression prevent me from knowing my desirous thought if, for me to feel guilt and conflict, I already have to know my desirous thought? It is a paradox, and it's one that's haunted psychoanalysis for many, many years. So now I need to make a distinction. And this is one I'm going to stick to, but in all honestly, I need to tell you that out in the academic world, there are people that don't make a distinction between suppression and repression. I'm going to make that distinction because I find it useful in my own work. But some people think that once you become so skilled at suppression, it can happen so automatically that it's no longer conscious. And I agree with that. Okay? You can get so expert at suppression that it happens like a skill. You don't even notice that you're doing it. But repression theoretically requires that the whole defensive process occurs outside of conscious awareness. So I'm in some state right now of which I'm unaware right now. That's what Freud means by dynamically unconscious states. So think of it this way, and I'm going to have to sort of present this, and then I'm going to give you problems with this way of thinking about it. So you think of the repressed desires as a bunch of party crashers, and morality, your superego, has hired a big bouncer, a doorman, who's the censor. And the censor's got a list of people, basically, like repressed desires and impulses, that aren't allowed into even the preconscious or they're allowed into the preconscious but not into full conscious awareness. And these are the people who say that are not allowed into the nightclub. Bankers, vice chancellors, real estate agents, fascist dictators, these people are not allowed into this particular nightclub. So as soon as he recognizes the party crashes, initially they're indistinct as they get closer and closer, as the repressed longings and desires pressing for conscious awareness and expression get closer to actually making you do something or think something, you spy them and think, uh-oh, not these guys. You're not allowed, and he chucks them out back into the unconscious. And this is very much the way that it sounds when Freud is writing about repression. And it's a particular kind of story that he tells about repression, which I call the systemic account of repression, as though the unconscious is one system with the attributes, qualities, and descriptors, and the conscious is another system with different attributes, qualities, and descriptors. Okay, so that's called the systemic theory of repression, or the systemic theory of unconscious processes. And Freud often talks about this, often when he's talking to a public audience. He says the sensor is like a watchman between two rooms. He examines the different mental impulses, acts as a sensor, and will not admit them. In other words, won't allow them in. But it's quite interesting, the kind of the word admit also means verbally to acknowledge the truth of something, which is close, will not admit them into the drawing room if they displease him. So what's really interesting here is that it's as if one part of you knows something that another part of you knows nothing about. So when psychoanalysis talks about you being a stranger to yourself or being a split subject in some way, that's exactly what it means. It means there's one part of you that knows a whole lot of stuff, and there's another part of you that knows nothing about that stuff. And so I might say, I really have no animal impulses. I'm only capable of recognition and love, and I may fully believe that to be true, okay? But I am self-deluded because there's another part of me that's concerned with sex, hunger, aggression, pain avoidance, temperature control, that's very animalistic, but I may not be aware of that. Okay. So in a sense, in this kind of mean exchange where the bankers and the fascist dictators get chucked out of the nightclub, your superego's in the clear. Your sense of I is in the clear because you don't even know who's on that list. You know, you don't know the list of people that are getting chucked out. So it seems as though there's no problem about self-deception entailing that I both know something and don't know something in the same person. Yes. Oh, yes, interesting. The question was, I'll try and repeat it, tell me if I missed the crucial bits. Okay, so I said in the last lecture that psychopaths are quite capable of having separate senses of self and they can act differently in different situations. And what would be the difference between a psychopath and a normal person who has these different agencies going on? Is that about right? Okay, cool. That's why this lecture is called Repression with a Hint of Dissociation. Spot on question and really fantastic. I don't know if I can give you a full account this early in the lecture, but I'll do my best. No, let me try, and because I love stealing my own thunder, and you know, and if it works, yay, we're going ahead of ourselves, and that's great. Okay, so repression is sometimes called the horizontal split, in that there's the unconscious, the preconscious, and the conscious, right? But I, down the bottom are all my drives with all their different wantings and longings and knowings, and my affects with the different wantings, longings, and knowings. And when they get into conscious awareness, I've got one sort of focus of attention more or less, and I can more or less integrate and weigh up my different impulses and longings. So I get a kind of sense of unity from my ego. Okay? But if I split my ego, okay, then this part of my ego can be the trickster, charmer, you know, hot psychopathic lover, and this part can be the murderous, rage-filled, vulnerable, starved child psychopath. Do you know what I mean? And so you can actually have dissociated self states, which is called the vertical split. Exactly that. In that, and I've written stuff on this, in that most of us do have partitions, like, you know, being a high self monitor, you know, you might hide certain of your feelings in a boring meeting out of politeness. You might really want to run away and eat chocolate cake and drink coffee, but you sit there and you're polite and you even listen, you know, and that's good. That's good. But you know that part of you would just love to be anywhere else but here, right? In other words, there's partitions, but you can look over them. And you know that part of you is really bored out of your brain here, okay? But the real partitioning is where you can't look over those partitions. You don't even know that there's another self state that you go into. And so it's a highly contested thing within psychology, whether dissociation really, in that vertical split sense, really exists. But that's what Janet, Charcot, Modern Prince, those are the three major writers, that's what they would have been talking about when they talked about dissociation. And it's a little bit different from repression. It often entails repression in that each self state has got some repression going on. So usually with vertical splits, there's also horizontal splits in those self states as well. Yeah. You're welcome. Thanks. Great question. Love it. I wasn't quite sure if I was going to get that hint of dissociation in today. So now that's, I feel quite relieved all of a sudden. Great. Okay. So, but with self-deception, it is a bit of a problem. It's as if I know and don't know one in the same moment. But if you've got different agencies within the self in terms of the horizontal split, different parts of you know different things, basically. However, if the ego is the thing that's responsible for the conscious knowing, but according to Freud, the ego is also the agent of repression, it's the ego that does the repressing, then we are in trouble, because the ego has to know that list of bankers and fascist dictators and not know it at one and the same moment. So it's a problem and it's a difficulty. There's another problem. Who is the real person here? Because when we talk about a person, and it's hard to keep in mind a person when you're thinking psychoanalytically, is the person the ego? Is it the superego? Is it the unconscious drives? Is it all of them? Well, it can't be all of them all of the time, because you don't know what's going on in the superego all of the time, and you don't know what's going on in the unconscious much of the time. So when we talk about a person, what are we talking about? Is it the person or the agency that knows most of what's going on at any one moment in your full psychic apparatus? Well, in that case, the doorman, the sensor, is the person, because the doorman knows more than anybody. Knows about the bankers, knows about the unconscious impulses, knows what morality wants, knows how to get those guys out of here, or those women out of here. Okay, so Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, who was the person that hassled Freud a lot, or hassled Freudian theory a lot about this, says the doorman is more of a person than the so-called person. And philosophers love this kind of thing, and I suppose I do too. Okay, so Sartre says, you know, inventing the sensor, inventing the doorman doesn't solve your problem. Because it just means that the doorman's more of a person. Who gave him the list? Personal morality. So personal morality and the ego enforcing that morality must know and not know. So all you've done is shift the problem around. If you've got a sensor, then repression occurs across the divide between the preconscious and the unconscious. Okay? If morality's in on the deal, then the divide is between the conscious and the preconscious. So you're just shifting the interface of difficulty around. So it's all very well to say repression occurs when a drive would bring pleasure to one part of the psychic apparatus and unpleasure to another part. But how do you keep those zones apart? Because when we deceive others, it's easy, because the person that's doing the deceiving is one person and they're deceiving another person. So there's no paradox there. But in self-deception, the deceiver and the deceived seem to coincide. So this is my answer, and for what it's worth, it was given to me by John Mays in his lectures and writing, and I've read around it for a while now, and I do think this solution might work. I think not just theoretically, I think it fits with some of the more contemporary evidence, like the stuff I was reading today. Okay, so the one answer is that the solution isn't spatial, that we have to chuck out the notion of the unconscious as a place, and we have to chuck out the notion as the unconscious as a system. In fact, the solution of knowing in order not to know is a temporal one. It's to do with time. And I'm just going to steal my own thunder so that you stay with me over the next few slides. So what I mean by that is that I have a fleeting awareness of my own impulses. I think, gosh, I really want to sleep with my sister's husband, right? Oh, that conflicts with my morality so greatly, okay? It sets up so much anxiety that the normal perseveration that occurs to make a fleeting momentary perception turn into a long-term memory, that kind of consolidation process, doesn't occur. It's as if I had the thought, anxiety erupted like a sort of psychic pistol shot that so disrupted me that I go, oh, what was I just thinking? I don't know, but it's left me feeling really anxious. Okay? So in other words, for a moment, I do know what I'm not supposed to know. And it causes anxiety. And the anxiety is so great that I don't lay down the long-term memory of having known something or having wanted something. So it's a temporal solution. And there are a number of writers that have talked about this kind of thing. So imagine you're a very anxious doorman. You're hypervigilant to threat. You're very sensitized to the possibility of certain happenings. You see them coming from afar. You think, oh, no, it's them. Quick, get the full house sign. Turn them away. Phew, that was close. And then there's that thing that I was telling you about. You're left with your hands shaking. You're left anxious. But what just happened? I'm so stressed, I can't recall clearly. Something just happened, but I forget. Gosh, I'm very shaky, but I don't know what I, you know, just experienced fully. So that's the sort of temporal solution to both knowing in order not to know, and it rescues the possibility that repression can occur as a process that remains entirely outside of awareness. So you never come to know the component features of what it is that you desire and feel conflict about. Now, one of the difficulties is that in talking in this way, we often personify the ego as though it's a little man. We personify the sensor or the preconscious as though it's a little man. And it sounds like it's an intentional agency, a little person in its own right with beliefs, desires, thoughts, memories, etc. And it's as if it preemptively senses itself. Sometimes even the repressed impulses sound like wily, savvy, smart things that go, oh yeah, there's that bouncer that never lets us in. We'll dress up differently tonight so he doesn't recognize us, that we're the ones he chucked out the other night. And I put in this morning, think bankers in drag, trying to get into this nightclub where bankers are not allowed. Okay. So sometimes it's like the repressed has thoughts, beliefs, and desires, but sometimes it's the sensor as doorman that's portrayed as an intentional agency. Now, Freud doesn't want you to think in terms of an homunculus, a little man. He says it's nothing more than a serviceable term for a dynamic relation. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about knowing as a relation. And that relation can be disrupted. It can be disrupted by emotion. I was thinking something, but it made me anxious. So I'm no longer in relation to that thought. It's gone. And I just think that's the simplest way to think about dynamically unconscious processes, that something disrupts that knowing relation. And you no longer are able to be consciously aware of something that previously you were able consciously to be aware of. So repression doesn't occur at the behest of a little person or a little homunculus. It's actually just a clash of impulses. You know, a clash of impulses alongside certain beliefs, moral beliefs or attitudes that we have. So the knowing relation was there, it's them. The charge of affect of anxiety was so great that it disrupts the knowing relation. Now, when you read Freud, if you read him across his whole lifespan, and you get into all sorts of difficulties. Like in 1921, in Inhibition, Symptoms and Anxiety, he talks about anxiety triggers repression, right? I feel a bit anxious. Oh, God, it's them. I've got to repress them, not let them in. Okay, Freud, is anxiety something that causes repression Because, you know, you said before that when the idea gets split off and the affect gets transmuted into anxiety, that anxiety is the byproduct of repression. So what is it, Freud? You know, is anxiety the signal for repression? Or is it the byproduct of repression? Well, what's great? It's both. Yeah, it's like, that's why once you start to get really repressed, things go quite badly for you, because you get more and more and more anxious, which is one of the terrible things about anxiety. It breeds, you know, it feeds upon itself, and it's very hard to turn it off and just calm. Okay. And the crucial thing about anxiety is that it prevents that perseveration that would have turned that fleeting short-term memory into a longer-term memory. And so no memory gets laid down. The idea goes underground. But the sad thing is, no learning is occurring. You're not learning. Because it's disrupting the learning process. And I think that's one of the really interesting things about it. So anxiety can be free-floating, but it doesn't really stay free-floating, because it's one of the aims of repression, and Freud talks about this in, and I'm going to be really honest with you, chapter 7, subsection H of the Interpretation of Dreams, 1900. He says that the crucial thing is to manage the fate of the affect. If I'm managing not to think about things, but I'm walking around an anxious bundle of nerves, you couldn't honestly say that repression has been successful. I'm a mess, okay? I'm so anxious. So at least part of the process has to be somehow to manage that anxiety, and it's got to go somewhere. And one of the worst things about it is, man, it goes places. It goes places. For instance, imagine that I'm gay and I don't know I'm gay, and I experience desire towards a gay person, and I think, oh, I can't be gay, my parents would turn in their graves, you know, there's no way that can be true. So I don't have that thought anymore. I've still got the anxiety. I notice I feel anxious whenever I'm around a particular woman, and I go, she probably fancies me, because I'm feeling really impinged upon by this woman. She doesn't at all. Probably hasn't noticed me in the slightest, but I'm attributing to her something that's actually true of me. Okay, I'm projecting outwards something of my own mental state. You know, people that go, you know, you're picking a fight with me. No, I'm really not picking a fight with you. Do you know? You're just in a bit of an aggro mood, actually. Do you know? Projection, it's a terrible thing. It happens very much with things like anger and anxiety, which is why funerals and weddings can be so volatile, because there's all this anger and anxiety with nowhere to go. A very efficient way of containing anxiety, unfortunately, is that it can be converted into bodily symptoms. Now, that's a slightly magical, zany way of saying I can comfort eat. Okay, I'm anxious. I'm actually anxious about my sexuality. But for some reason, perhaps my developmental history, I've been taught that to soothe myself by food, okay? And quite quickly, I build up a body armor of weight, okay? And I don't know that my body armor of weight has got anything to do with my sexuality. In fact, it makes me slightly less appealing to a broader array of people if I get too large. And so it solves the problem, in a sense, because now nobody's hassling me for sex or something, you know, so I can tune out to my own sexuality somewhat. Now, that's an exaggerated sort of caricature, but that is the kind of way that psychoanalysis thinks of conversion symptoms. And so one of the hallmarks of a bodily symptom, when it's not actually a genuine physical illness, is that the person is often quite unconcerned about it. They have what's called the belle indifférence, the French way of, like, What bodily symptom? Oh, yes, my hand's slightly paralyzed, but that doesn't matter, do you know? I can't go outdoors, but that's fine, do you know? In other words, you don't really, it's as if you really can't pay too much attention to the bodily symptom and its meaning. As people with obsessive compulsive disorder know, and I have very good friends that are slightly OCD, and I wish I was a bit more OCD, just to put that out there. They have inhibitions, things they can't do. They have rituals like checking that the door's locked, that the iron's turned off, etc., which is just a way of containing anxiety. Quite famous sports people often have rituals. You know, when you watch guys sort of rubbing the cricket ball, supposedly to roughen it up, to get it to sort of spin better. Yeah, right. You know, it's also a really fantastic little ritual to manage your anxiety when the next shot or the next over is crucial. Okay. The crucial thing that you need to know, particularly about the sex drive, is that if morality says you can't have this, you'll take the next best thing. You'll deflect or metonymically displace your desire onto the next best thing, the closest option. And you displace it onto an object that doesn't cause quite as much anxiety. And that's what makes you socializable. No, you're not allowed to murder your opponents, but you can beat them in cricket. Okay, right? Yes. Oh, no, reaction formation, that's a really good question. Is this the same as reaction formation, or is reaction formation a different thing? Reaction formation would go as follows. Let me see if I can give you a good account of it. I'll use the example I gave last week about pottery being about playing with your poos, all right? You know, say I do have an impulse to play with my feces. And I'm aware that that's going to get me into real difficulty because I've seen the disgust on my mother's face, right? And I want to keep on side with my mother because if she doesn't feed me, I'm dead, right? So even though I really want to play with my own feces, I would go, ooh, no, it's really important that cleanliness is all. Cleanliness is next to godliness, you know? And I might actively persecute potters, you know, because they're really just playing with their poos when you think about it. And everyone else is going, are you for real? They're making beautiful clay objects, you know, but it feels so obvious to the person with the covert desires what they're doing. So a reaction formation is where you moralize around something that you covertly desire. So, for example, was it last year? Fred Nile got caught with something like 3,900 hits on a porn site from his computer, where he had to log on with his own personal username and password, so it couldn't have been anyone else that went to the porn sites. Look, it's one thing to know what's out there, but 3,000 hits? You know what I mean? So you see, what happens with film censors and people like that is they put themselves in a position where they get to see the films the rest of us never get to see, you know? But it's a reaction formation, but it's also covertly getting satisfaction. But they're not acknowledging to themselves that they're getting any satisfaction. They're having to watch all these filthy films, but someone's got to do it. Do you know what I mean? Someone's got to go to these porn sites just to make sure what's out there and protect the public. So a reaction formation is where you have an unconscious desire to do something. It clashes with your morality. And so rather than admitting to yourself that you desire that, you actively beef up or increase the cognitive and affective elaboration of a moral that says that is a disgusting thing for anyone to want to do. That's a reaction formation. Yeah, yeah, you're welcome. I know that was a bit long-winded, but it's a very, very common thing. You know, in Shakespeare, he says, methinks the lady doth protest too much. You know, when you say, oh, I would never do that. I'd never even dream of doing that. Never even crossed my mind. It's like, watch out. You know what I mean? It's like, Psychoanalysis is a dangerous thing. And a little bit of psychoanalysis is the most dangerous thing of all. Okay. So desire displaces onto something that doesn't cause such anxiety. That's sublimation. Reaction formation can sort of look like sublimation, but it usually becomes quite symptomatic, which means it's not quite sublimated anymore because it gets a bit costly. Yeah. Because you're so interested in the thing that you're pretending not to be interested in that sometimes you're devoting your whole life and your whole identity to it. Yeah. It's an attempt at sublimation, I suppose. Yeah. So what do we need for repression? What's the recipe for repression? How long have we got? So what do we need for repression? Primary ingredient, conflict, psychic conflict. With dissociation, conflict is absent. That's the distinction that I draw between repression and dissociation. There is no part of a child that desires sexual abuse. There is no part of a population that desires a tsunami. Okay. There's not, in other words, these are just traumatic, negative, external events that do not cause conflict within us, because there's no part of us that goes, gee, that would be a rough ride, a wild ride. Wish a tsunami would come here, do you know? Okay. Now, after the effects of it, you may feel guilty that you enjoyed the exhilaration of watching buildings get crushed and smashed, you know. So you may experience psychic conflict as a result of some of the pleasures of the tsunami or some of the pleasures of bodily contact. And then repression and dissociation can mix in reality. But theoretically, I think they're quite distinct. And theoretically, I think conflict has no place in dissociation. So that's important, because you don't want to blame the victims of childhood sexual abuse, saying that there was part of them that desired that. Sure, kids have active sexuality, but that sexuality needs no external object. They're autoerotic. They can satisfy their own bodily pleasures, and their sexuality is not genital sexuality. It's polymorphously perverse. So to give it a genital object too soon is to pervert the development of the child, and it's a violence. Okay, so you need psychic conflict. Agnes Patter, it's one of my dear friends and mega, mega intellects. She says, in order to accommodate the facts of mental conflict, there must be a conflict of interests within a single mind. There must be a plurality of drives, at least two. So in other words, you've got to at least have two drives to get repression up and running. And John Mays, who taught both Agnes and I, says one part of the psychological apparatus knows something that another part does not know. And that's the crucial assumption of psychoanalysis, is that we are split subjects, that there's part of us that knows something that another part of us doesn't know. So introspection is always going to be partial, and it's always going to be slightly opaque. There's going to be things that we can't readily report on. So, what do you need for repression? You need drive against drive, says Agnes. But I would say, and Agnes would not agree with me, okay, we've talked about this endlessly, and we're still talking about it, and we're writing about it, is that I think you can also have drive against affect. I think that can start repression. Because I think sometimes we're socialized, not just by drive against drive, but by disgust and by shame. And I think affects are quite powerful, quite powerful. And I think if you're feeling ashamed when you've, say, decided that you want to make love to someone and they shame you, not easy to still feel sexual in that situation. So I think affects can be very, very powerful.
That was the fourth lecture in the series Philosophy of Psychoanalysis, presented by Associate Professor Doris McIlwain. The theme song to the show was created by Rose Mackenzie Peterson. The producer is myself, Nina McIlwain. Thanks to Andrew Jeeves and John Sutton. Speak soon.